Thanks very much, Jennifer. Real quickly before we get the panel started, I want to say how happy I am to be back here at Rain Summit. It's been a few years, but it's great to see what Kurt and Jennifer and Brianna do and continue to do with the event. It's as good and better than ever, so congratulations to them on that. And congratulations as well to Brad for everything that he's done with the Rain newsletter. The depth of the coverage and the features is just, I think it's phenomenal and it's great. So congratulations to Brad, too. Very well done. I want to introduce people up on our panel here, and I'm going to do that kind of as we get into the questions, but I want to give a little bit of a background, kind of what Jennifer was talking about. There was a report in May from a trade group called the Association for Electronic Music, which says EDM is a $6.2 billion global industry. Billion with a B, global industry. This is based on revenue from these enormous festivals. Certainly you've heard about club dates, recorded music sales, streaming, and also very importantly, DJ software and hardware and lots more. In fact, there was a panel at a recent conference in Las Vegas in June called EDM Biz, I think it was in June, that agreed that the global value of this industry might actually be three times that, something closer to $20 billion. Nielsen says EDM is, quote, the only genre to post year-over-year sales gains in 2013, and Forbes put together a top 10 list of the top 10 DJs and compiled their earnings, and we're talking about annual $225 million in a year, top 10 DJs. Now, okay, here's our new style of music, or maybe not so new, and we'll get to that. We'll hear what the experts say about that. But something that's grown and developed outside of the realm of broadcast radio and the major record label system. Now, it has a unique fan base, and I want to learn more about that, and, of course, a huge potential marketing opportunity there. Now, the experts on the panel here are going to help us better understand who the EDM and electronic music fans are, how radio could possibly establish itself as a trusted source of this sort of content, and what role events like festivals play in giving marketing and branding, possible marketing and branding opportunities to broadcasters and webcasters. But first, we want to figure out, what's EDM music? What are we talking about EDM? So like lots of panels do, I'm going to do the show of hands here. Who in this room feels like they're pretty well-versed and know what I'm talking about when I say EDM? You're a fan of this music, you listen to it, you can kind of discuss the different genres. I mean, I want our panelists to know who we're going to be talking to. Who here feels more they're sort of more of a novice when it comes to this, and we really want to figure out more of what's going on for possible opportunities. Who came here to learn more about enterprise data management? Because that's maybe another. Yeah, down the hall, exactly. We'll have better music. And speaking of that, Rick back there, our sound guy, is going to help us out, and we're going to hear a little bit of what we're talking about when it comes to this style of music. So the first one in the main sort of subgenre we're talking about is called EDM. This is the very mainstream type of dance music. You hear it often on CHR stations. It's kind of the sound of a lot of pop music that's going on right now. It's mainstream dance. So Rick, if you can hit the file called EDM. Okay, another type of music you may have heard of is called house. It's usually a little bit slower. It has more of an R&B and disco feel to it. It has more melody than EDM. So, Rick, the file that says house.
All this is very hard to define.
Yes. In the dark room.
Classify them equally that like that. I mean, that's why people call it EDM, because right now there's no real way to classify quantify it, and I think you're losing if you're trying to put it into these little holes where
one of the problems with the term EDM is it's used in a couple of ways. It's used as a term to encompass all of the electronic music that's got a beat to it, and it's also used to describe one sort of like the big room or arena style of dance music. Look at the first clip you played.
Let's do one more. I'm only going to have Rick do one more here so we can get right into the panel. And this one is a genre that's kind of outside of the dance realm. It's called maybe chill electronica, slowest, relaxed. Rusty, you are founder and operator of a webcast service called Soma FM. You've been doing this a long time, since 1999.
Yeah, it's been a business since early 2000 and kind of an experiment for 6 months before that in 99.
A lot of the electronic music that you play probably, I would say, falls outside of what we call the dance music, the sort of mainstream EDM. But I do want to ask
We have a channel called The Trip,
certainly,
trans-y,
but you have
progressive
but how many,
house.
How many electronic channels do you have that are not that?
At least 12.
Okay. Just, you know, making that point. But, the interest and visibility of this music, the reason we're all up on this stage right now, you've been doing this a long time. Does this surprise you? Why is this happening now?
Does it surprise me? No. I mean, part of the reason Soma FM started is I was into that kind of the electronic music scene starting in the early 90s. And I was living in L.A. up until around 1991 or so, and they had some good electronic music program in some of the college radio stations. And I moved up to San Francisco and couldn't find any of it on the dial-up there, which is kind of traditional or kind of typical of just the whole country at that time. I couldn't find it anywhere. So I kept thinking, like, you know what? I need to start a radio station doing this. And I, had a lot of false starts for many years, first trying to do it as like syndicated program with existing FMs, and finally the internet got it to enough a point where it could actually stream music that sound decent, and then at that point Soma FM was born and started streaming a couple of different electronic music formats. The most popular one was a down tempo one, like the last Tycho track you played, and then we had another one which was just kind of we call it Secret Agent. It's like this electronic music that's got a kind of a spy movie soundtrack feel to it, which was it's happened to be like something I was into and collecting. I realized one day, like, I have like 800 tracks of this genre of music. So,
Ryan, you've been producing music. You're a Grammy nominated songwriter. You're a recording artist, a producer. You've been doing this for as long as Soma FM has been around, since 2099.
2000.
Same question. Why is this happening now? Why are we having this panel now? What happened that you see from your unique vantage point that this is something big that we're talking about now?
Well, I think, when we look at music right now, we just strip it down to looking at how music is made. Electronic music is primarily made, with your computer and with synthesizers and electronic instruments. And maybe years ago when someone wanted to, a music student wanted to start to dabble in music and to maybe pick up an instrument, they might have said, for their birthday, they'd like to have a guitar, something like this. And now today, with all the tools that are made available with inside the computer for you to be able to make music, a lot of younger people are, looking for a version of Ableton or Logic or something like this to start creating music. So I think that, take that and couple that with the effect that synthesizers and the sounds that are used to create electronic music, that effect that they have on you, the goosebumps that they give you, these kinds of things. I mean, it's a great feeling. It's a great experience to listen to this music. And so it's just natural that this music would continue to grow. And as we see it now, it's crossing over into all different types of genres and the derivatives of all of that that's going to come from that. Like, it's not going to slow down. It's going to continue to, continue to go up. And
I have a sense that maybe Adalyn would agree with you on that. Adalyn, you direct artist relations and EDM initiatives at Clear Channel, and you are the program director for iHeartRadio Clear Channel's Evolution programming. And we talked about that EDM Biz conference. You were there, right? You spoke there?
I spoke on a panel called 20-something that my best friend Jake Udell curated.
Okay. I want to know about that conference. I mean, you were there. What were people talking about, not only on stage and on the panels, but, you know, in the hallway and things like that? This was a big conference, right? This is like 1,000 attendees.
Yeah, I mean, it's the third year. It's probably the most credible at this point, most seriously taken dance music conference in the country. What used to be WMC is pretty much now for this. It happens right before the Electric Daisy Carnival, which is a 300,000 person dance music event.
They sold 320,000 tickets.
Mm-hmm. Without a radio station.
And what was the price on those tickets? They were expensive.
Yeah, very expensive. And that's outside of Las Vegas. And, you know, it really, look, they have your typical artist panel, and they have label panels, but then they also kind of delve into more of the business side about where we're going with dance music and where the industry as it, what is happening becomes mainstream. Where is that all going? And a lot of the topics that we discuss there, because what I do is very different from what these other guys here do, and each of us represent different pieces of it. What I work on is making commercially viable dance music products, and so that's Darren Davis, who's just up here, was speaking about iHeartRadio and Premier Networks, and we really try to use those platforms at Clear Channel to spread the gospel, if you will, of what we're doing in dance music. And I think we're doing it the best right now on such a mass scale, and it's really exciting.
You were talking about the business of this. Joel, you are someone who you have your company now is Pulse Radio, Pulse 87 New York, and now live in Vegas on the air. You also have a background in programming CHR radio, and you were at SiriusXM.
It's interesting to hear the discussion about how, is this new now today? Like, why are we doing this for the first time today? We had Pulse 87 on the air in New York 6 years ago, okay? And it was for a bunch of reasons that the company went away, and I took the brand and put it back up on the internet. It's been running there for 4 years. So before any of the CHR stations that you're probably most familiar with ever heard of who David Guetta was or Calvin Harris or some of these people, we were playing them on the air in New York on a little signal that was actually, for those of you that are technically in this direction, it was a Channel 6. It was one of those Franken FMs that everybody used to talk about. The audio portion shows up at 87.7 approximately on your dial. And, on that sort of remote location on a frequency that about 20% of the radios that exist can't tune down to, and on a signal in New York that if you happen to be facing west in your office, you probably couldn't pick up, that station had 1 million listeners a week. And I have a few friends at Clear Channel who've been fairly candid in telling me that they were really kind of happy that it wasn't on a real signal in New York. So I've been kind of an advocate for this for quite a while. In a previous life, I put Hot 97 on the air in New York when it was a dance station back then. That was the last sort of iteration of this. Hot 97, Power 106, which was a Hot 105 in Miami that Bill Tanner programmed then. And those radio stations, those dance stations, before anybody gave it the name EDM, those radio stations, those weird dance stations, beat Kiss FM in LA. They beat Z100 in New York. I don't know who the mainstream CHR in Miami was at the time, but Bill Tanner ran circles around them with this. And the music today that's available for this format is light years ahead of what we were playing on the radio in the late 80s and the early 90s. You've got records that are now quote-unquote EDM or dance music that would nominally be part of this format that are playing on AAA stations, that are playing on alternative stations. They're crossing before the CHRs find out about them. Then they find out about them 3, 4, 5, 6 months later, and then they get on them. So this isn't really news at this point. It may be news, to some, I guess, but this has been going on for a while. That we're running this radio station in Las Vegas now as of about 2 months ago. There's already early signs that it's starting to grow because it is in a metered market. So I'm pretty optimistic. There's a few stations around the country that are in some pretty big markets that might do well to look up and pay attention to this stuff because there's an opportunity there to sort of run around a mainstream CHR that might be a competitor in the market as opposed to like running face first into them.
You have probably a pretty good example of what you're talking about at SFX Entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't believe me, ask Bob Silverman. He just spent $140 million to get into the festival business. And it is a little bit different. Festivals don't necessarily translate into ratings on a radio station or vice versa, but to Ellen's point earlier, the Electric Daisy show in Vegas sells 300,000 tickets without the benefit of radio promotion. The iHeart Radio Festival is 50,000 tickets, 25,000 tickets.
Yeah, that,
okay, with 600 of the biggest radio stations in America promoting it and supporting it, and now it's on TV. So that's not to take it. That's a great show and it's a great platform for what they do. But here's a platform that a lot of people that are certainly, if not in here, the ones that are going to be at the NAB conference in a couple days would go, that's just like weird stuff. I mean, it's going right past without you guys.
I don't know if I agree. I don't think it's one or the other. I think what I see, and certainly like one of the first artists that I broke was Calvin Harris. And I sat there at Coachella this year when Calvin had the biggest crowd of any other artist at the festival, and he wasn't even headlining on the main stage.
Right, that's a rock festival, basically.
You can't tell me that he didn't get that without mainstream radio. You just can't. So as big as these guys are on the underground, I have Armin van Buuren and these guys who are gods at EDM and sell tickets like rock bands wish they could sell. They can't. But the ones that can do both and do both well, like Calvin, like David Guetta, It puts them in a completely different stratosphere than their peers, and as well as other artists from other genres of music.
What do you know about Evolution's listeners? Where do they come from as far as other genres of radio? Where do they come from as far as other media? Who are you sharing these people with? How do you get them?
Our most exciting, so what most people don't understand about Evolution is it's the platform that we use for dance music at Clear Channel. It's not one piece of it. It's everything that we're doing that has anything to do with dance music. We're branding Evolution. And one of my favorite things that I get to work on with that is our Evolution program that we've done with SFX on Premier Networks, which is hosted by Pete Tong. For those of you who know Pete Tong, he's a longtime BBC Radio 1 dance music host. And that's 2 hours of syndicated programming that we do on about 85 top 40 stations across the country before midnight. So on KISS FM in Los Angeles, on Z100 in New York City, and it kicks ass. And Pete's whole job is, presents himself on the show is different to if you're familiar with his show. He realizes that he's speaking to an audience who are fairly novice with dance music, and he's not trying to make them feel alienated or that this is something too cool that they can't understand. He's trying to bring them in like, oh, you like Rihanna? Well, Rihanna did a song with Calvin Harris called We Found Love. You should hear this other song by Calvin Harris. And he kind of makes and delivers it in a way that brings people to the party. And then once that two-hour show is done, we're like, yo, if you've liked what you've heard, you can hear it all day 24/7 on iHeartRadio for free. So it's kind of tying the whole loop of everything we do and kind of giving this new rabid dance music fan that we've created through our radio platform, giving them somewhere to go and somewhere to kind of learn more.
Okay, but does it have to have the Rihanna vocals on it, or does it have to have Sia or something
that? Absolutely not. I mean, I think dance music songs are now breaking top 40 artists. I mean, Sam Smith sang on Latch by Disclosure before he got big, and now he's a monster. You know, I think that what I tell artists and labels who bring me non-vocal tracks, a lot of times dance music is produced, and Ryan, I'm sure you can agree to this, is produced to be mixed into other tracks, and for either if you're mixing quickly or if you're mixing slowly. Dance records that are made for the radio have to be made like every other song on the radio. It's called a radio edit for a reason.
Right. And it needs to be a song.
Yeah, and if it's going
to
sit...
People like to sing along to the radio.
And not even that. It needs to be able to stand on its own and perform. And very few non-vocal tracks do that. I mean, the best one, I think, is Greyhound by Swedish House Mafia. But they have to be that much better. And, you know, we get a lot of, I mean, I'm sure, Joel, you get this too, people being like, there's so much music out there, how do you choose? I think it's awesome, because the ones that win are really that
they
much better.
Huge, and they win big.
It's funny, you mentioned Greyhound. Is it true that was, I mean, that was written for a product? Is that?
It was a campaign that they did with Absolute. I mean, the music was already there. Amy Thompson's a genius.
Okay. A lot of people get their first exposure to a lot of the electronic music is through TV ads or background music in TV shows, because there's been stuff that we've played for years and then suddenly it comes out, oh, it's in the car ad.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I thought was interesting is we found, just querying our audience a lot, we get a lot of ad agency and creative types listen to us just kind of while they're working. And they discover artists, like, I'll get contact. It's like, hey, this person, how do I get in contact with them? We want to use them for a commercial. So it's kind of interesting that a lot of people, the mainstream exposure to a lot of stuff, EDM, came through the commercial way. Like, the music was created for an audience, but then the commercial people used it, and that's where it became famous. So it's sort of like a different method of exposure.
I was reading an article, and this is kind of going off on a tangent, but about... And Ryan, I do want to ask you, because you've done lots of partnerships and things like that, and we haven't delved quite yet into the demo of the core listeners for these styles of music. But one of the things that struck me was, for a lot of types of music, maybe hip hop broke this mold, but we had, you know, this taboo against selling out, somehow being part and parcel with Madison Avenue or being part of a partnership, and so blatantly marketing something was just something that you didn't do. And now, from what I've read, this article said that that's off the table. That's no longer true, especially even for the ardent fans of this music. They don't care. In fact, if it means their artists are going to get more support and a wider appeal, they're cool with that. Is that true?
I think so.
Ryan, please answer for the entire
the entire
industry.
Artists.
I think it depends on the consumer. You're going to have people who are on the underground who are always going to be there and going to be stoked on it. I mean, there's a reason. There's a reason that there are.
On the microphone.
I don't know why it's.
Ah, there you go. The antenna's on the bottom.
But I think that there's a reason that some artists who have been huge on the underground will always be. So it's like you have, you know, Fish. With this massive following, and they're always going to be stoked in doing that. But then you've got Motley Crue. I'm not saying they're the same, but within dance music, you have a guy like Carl Cox, who's the biggest techno producer and one of my favorites for years and years. And I've gotten asked on a panel before, well, why can't I hear Carl Cox on Z100? You know what? If Carl Cox wanted to be on Z100, he'd make a song to be on Z100. Mm-hmm. He's happy and, as an artist, is fulfilled with what he's doing. And if that means bringing in a brand, awesome. Yeah. If it doesn't, great.
Ryan, why aren't you on Z100? Are you fulfilled otherwise? I think it's an interesting point. I'd like to hear.
I really like what you just said about Carl Cox. Like, I mean, I think, you know, like for me, as an artist... I just make the music that I love, you know, and certainly once you get your sort of skill set to a certain place, you know, you can dive into, you know, all kinds of genres as a producer. And I think, you know, and everything like in a season, you know, it's sort of like, I think the Swedish House Mafia, the Greyhound track, you know, I mean, like, I thought that was amazing. Like, I loved everything about that track. I loved everything about that was, you know, put together with an advertising campaign. And I thought that was brilliant, and I really appreciated all of the things that went around that entire piece there. And I think, like, guys like that will be fine whether or not they do things like that or they don't. You know, they're talented. They, you know, I mean...
And they also choose what they want to do, right? They're not going to, you know...
No, they're not having to do it.
They're going to... Whenever, you know, at premiere with Pete Tong, we sell it like every other syndicated radio show. Like we're doing with Ryan, like we're doing with Elvis Duran. If we get brought a product that Pete's not going to get behind, he's not going to talk about it on air. He's not going to support... It's the same thing. It just... Advertisers are more aggressive about EDM right now because they may not understand it, but they understand that a lot of people are obsessed with it and they want to be involved.
I think also when you talk about the selling out, it depends where the artist is in the in their career, not so much in their career as producing, but their career as a brand. Because there's a lot of EDM artists that are producing just a tremendous amount of music. They're not real well known. Lots of DJs are playing, their stuff is being heard, and they're kind of like, when they have some advertiser or ad agency come to them and say they want to use one of their tracks, you're like, awesome, more people to hear my music, great. And there's nothing to be perceived as selling out because there's really nothing for them to sell out. They don't have some brand established with their fans and audiences yet to sell out. Sometimes you see some of the EDM guys that are in such, you know, they're such a big brand themselves, they're not going to be as eager to have their music used in something that they don't care a lot about. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe someone will let it be used in a commercial, you know, a big name will let it be used in a commercial if it's something they either think the commercial itself is cool or they think the product is cool. But so it's a different approach to selling out.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk? I want to talk a little bit about the listener who's listening to this music, and I have a couple ideas here, and I've read a few things, and I want you folks to set me straight and tear it apart and tell me. You know, I mean, we have technology now that, you know, more than ever before lets us know who is actually listening, and Nielsen has studied these people as consumer profiles. They're calling the typical EDM listener, they're millennials under the age of 25. They index extremely high as influencers among their peers. They themselves are more likely than partisans of other genres to find artists and new music through streaming and iTunes, though radio still dominates. They're tech adopters who purchase devices more and sooner than other genre partisans. So, I mean, right there is an obvious opportunity for partnerships in mobile and tech. And, what I mentioned before, EDM fans want brands to sponsor artists. The columnist, I was referring to this article from The Verge. The guy's name was Trent Wolby, and he says, EDM fans are primarily millennials whose hashtags, likes and shares create a precisely quantifiable consumer. EDM has created a new class of highly engaged spenders. That sounds
pretty nice 100%. For radio.
Sounds like an opportunity.
Exactly. I mean, these, you know, I actually...
So you agree?
I agree 100%. Yeah. Okay.
I think they actually are a little bit older than that in some cases.
No, I think there's the live event piece, too. If we go back to the Electric Daisy Carnival kind of example... it's in Las Vegas, and there are most people who are going to this festival are coming in from out of town. And so Las Vegas as a city is stoked on it because they make a ton of money because everyone's coming in for this event. They're going to spend money in the hotels and the casino, and they're going to, you know, bring a bunch of friends. They're going to buy a bunch of booze. They're going to do, you know, get taxis out there. It is big business, and these kids, part of the reason that dance music kind of, it's technological, right? So it's always been at the forefront of making the music with the different technology as it evolves. And with personally accessible internet, if your friend is at a bar telling you about a cool DJ, you can look it up right then and there and listen to it. And you haven't had that with previously booming genres of music.
Someone in one of our early discussions brought up the idea that that is going to be the fuel for the staying power of this music because it is so much a part of the technology that everyone has access to anyway. Joel, you mentioned, though, that you think maybe it's even already started going beyond 25.
I mean, I've seen recently in Las Vegas that the audience does tend to skew a little bit older than that and older than you might, you know, otherwise think. And part of that is because if you're under 21, you can't go into clubs. You can't. I don't know if there's an age limit or not for like Electric Daisy or not. But
they're increasing it. Right? Ultra just raised their age to 18
so
from
16. So the audience for this, you're getting a slightly different look of people that are going to festivals versus who's listening to this stuff on the radio. And it does seem to skew a little bit older. It has forever. You know, it's been like that.
Rusty and Ryan, are your audiences a little older than that?
Ours is. I mean, ours is all over, but I mean, we have a. I would say the majority of our audience is, 30s, 40s. You know, every now and then not that infrequently, probably like once every 2 weeks, I get an email from someone like, "I just discovered your music. This is amazing. You wouldn't. I'm a 65 year old man, and my kids can't believe I listen to this stuff. It's amazing." The thing that's interesting is like. What I find interesting is that it doesn't just appeal to a certain group. A certain group may be very attracted to it, but it's not like it's like, oh, I'm 50 years old, I can't listen to that kind of music. No, you can
some
totally
of it's just mood
it.
Music for people. It's fun, you know, somebody that you would not necessarily think about being a fan of electronic dance music, mm-hmm. while they're having a bunch of people over at their house, so they just put it on, and it might come off of mm-hmm. one of those music choice channels that they were talking about earlier when Kurt made his presentation. Come from a million of streaming, you know, if they're going that way, but it does transcend what you would think of as mm-hmm. a bunch of like, you know, drug crazed kids.
All the time I get a message that, you know, that the parent was introduced to my music from their kid. Yeah,
your partner Ryan, some of your partnerships include Audi and Bang & Olufsen, right?
Yeah,
so this is not
free Audis?
No. I wish.
You didn't get yours?
Are they like preloading your music on their sound systems in their car? Or are they using it for commercials? Or
It was for a commercial. And you can see it on YouTube. If you go to Audi America, Audi of America's YouTube channel, basically they gave me their A8, which came with the new Bang & Olufsen stereo. And a lot of times, what I'll do and what many producers will do is we will work on the mix of a song, and then we'll test that mix in the car. Because the car as a venue, as a place to sort of enjoy the music, I mean, that's where it's really up close and personal to the listener. A lot of times you find yourself listening to music when you're on a commute, you're by yourself, you're really listening to it with virtually no other distractions, you know? What I did, they came over and we shot a piece where I was working in the studio, and then, you know, I did what I sort of reenacted what I normally do, which is I don't have an A8, but I do have an Audi, and I pop it in and take it for a sort of a test drive.
I can't believe they didn't loan you an A8 for this.
They did. Yeah, they did. Okay, they did, yeah. But they took it back.
Hopefully, you know, we can run some of that video if we have time. But I do want to let maybe someone smarter than me ask some of you guys some questions here. Kurt has a question.
Thanks. Hello, Paul. But long-time reader. First time.
Welcome
to the
program.
Ask a questioner from the audience. Ryan, I would like to hear a little bit more about your background and how you became successful and how online radio and or, you know, streaming music services help you do that. Okay. I think we haven't heard enough of your history yet.
Okay. Well, basically, sort of my life journey with music started when I was 4 years old with the violin. When I was 10 years old, I had played at the White House, and when I was 11, I had played at the White House again on the violin. In junior high, I discovered drums and rock music and all kinds of things that sort of took me away from that classical background and took me sort of into playing with bands and groups and different things like this. And it was around 2000, 2001 that I had recorded my very first music, and I put it up on this website called mp3.com. Now, the mp3.com that was then is not really the same mp3.com that is now. But back then, when I put my music up on this site, what started happening was my music started, I gave it away for free. So you could stream it for free, you could download it for free. And so if we're looking at like the year 2001, 2002, you know, internet wasn't quite as, you know, broadband as fast as it is now. So someone actually spending 30, 45 minutes downloading your song, you know, it kind of meant something. So what mp3.com had done, it was something really interesting and really, really good for the artists. They had this program called Payback for Playback. And what that meant was that they were sharing a portion of the advertising revenue that your page was generating through all of the people listening and downloading your music. So Right towards the end there, it had been about 2 years. I'd given away 1,800,000 and some thousand downloads. I don't know how many streams. It was great. It had given me about $40,000 in the Payback for Playback program. And at that time and even today, that was a significant amount of money for an upcoming artist. And it allowed me to be able to continue to do this and continue to make money. And do this for a living. And so basically, in 2008, I created my own record label. It's called Rhytone Entertainment. And all of my music is released under that label. And, I want to thank Jennifer for inviting me to be here. And the reason I'm here, I guess, is because, I'm an artist that has never really had any mainstream radio support, all of my support comes directly from the people who are fans of this music and who support me in that way. And it's through Pandora, it's Spotify, and it's YouTube. And this is where the type of music that I make that doesn't have the support of traditional radio, it's a situation where the fans of this music are able to to come get what they want and almost sort of get it directly from the artist. So that's sort of my sort of thing. I also compose music, and through the years, I've licensed my music to dozens of different placements and opportunities: Chevrolet, Rack Bank, Bang & Olufsen, Audi. It goes Despicable Me 2, licensed one of my songs for the marketing of that movie last summer. So, that's kind of my musical story. So that's what I do.
Anyone else have some questions for the panel? John, we've got one back here and one in front.
I was listening to you guys, and I don't know much about EDM, but it sounds to me like you've basically benefited by distribution platforms being available to you beyond a commercial and the long tail. So to that end, this is a radio room mm-hmm. with a lot of commercial interests in it. And I'm just wondering, because I've heard different things from the panel on this topic, do you feel that how would commercial have impacted your industry from an EDM? You get a lot of legitimacy by almost not being commercial. Then I have Clear Channel here who's kind of like, no, we can leverage it.
Yeah,
I kind of wanted to know, how much do you feel like, then you over here kind of said, I think that there's value because you've created a bonding or intimacy as a consequence of not being commercial, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different variables going on about how much does EDM really... I'm just trying to figure out how to apply that to the distribution.
I'll just say that I'm surprised that commercial FM has not jumped on the broader electronic music scene, especially the stuff that some of our more popular things, like our Groove Salad channel, which is more of the down-tempo electronic music. It's mostly instrumental. It's stuff that people listen to while they're working. In some ways, I see it as a much cooler version of smooth jazz, but everybody listens to it. Gets into it, enjoys it, and I don't understand why that hasn't taken off bigger on commercial radio. It should have.
Guys, thank you very much, Adalyn.
I'm really sorry. I have to actually run.
Adalyn, Rusty, Ryan, yes. Joel, thank you, everyone.